pussy sweeter than my sweetie when I meet her in the morning.
The morning.
With the morning glory.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you will hear reminiscences of life around North Carolina's Triangle area in earlier times, written by local authors. On today's program, I'll be reading excerpts from Backyards, Bow Ties, and Beauty Queens, written by Bill Thompson in 2008. For years, Bill Thompson has delighted readers of Our State magazine with his folksy essays in Front Porch Stories, and audiences with tales that explore his down-home roots. In this sequel to his first book, Sweet Tea, Fried Chicken, and Lazy Dogs, Bill offers another collection of more than 50 essays that explore his reflections on North Carolina life and people. His warm commentaries, sometimes humorous, sometimes poignant, capture the essence of rural and small-town life in North Carolina. Why I Haven't Lost My Marbles. I'm probably the only person in the world who doesn't know what a Pokemon is. I don't even know if that's the correct way to pronounce it. Whatever it is, it's not the first, nor doubtless the last such invention to take over the minds and money of today's children. Remember the hula hoop, cabbage patch dolls, matchbox cars? I've mentioned at other times the propensity for children to play with boxes that expensive toys come in. I still believe that a child's creative imagination can come up with more interesting toys than anything we adults can contrive. For instance, I believe that a child invented marbles. No adult could come up with something so simple. Little glass balls with all the colorful hues that could catch the eye of a child. A game of marbles requires no electricity, batteries or otherwise, and no assembly is required. The rules of the game aren't written in three languages on the back of the box it came in. Marbles don't always even come in a box. The main attraction of marbles is not the game itself. Certainly it is a great game, a game of skill and strategy. But the main attraction, for me, is the marbles themselves. There's something sensual about the smooth feel of the marbles, something about that spherical shape that challenges you. You can't stack marbles without some foreign constraint. Their smoothness makes them elusive. You can't push them together. Their hardness makes them resilient. You can force them against each other, but it's almost impossible to break one marble with another. They just bounce off. Each marble is unique. I'm sure that there may be some marble somewhere that's an exact duplicate of another, but if you look at it long enough, a marble's appearance will change right before your eyes. The shade of a color will darken or brighten as the sun's rays strike it. Once you find one that seems to be a genuine one-of-a-kind, that's a keeper. Its value is far above rubies. You don't even put it in the ring for fear it may be taken. When I was a boy, marbles used to come either in a great big jar or in a small bag. They were relatively inexpensive. If you were lucky or looked hard enough, you might run up on a marble that was bigger than the others. That was the shooter. Sometimes, depending on the neighborhood, some guy would come up with a steely, a ball bearing gouged out of a piece of metal found down at the local garage. In some neighborhoods, a steely was illegal, the legality being determined by majority vote of the players. Of course, if the guy who owned the steely happened to be much bigger than any other player, the rule could be waived. Serious marble players carried their marbles in a small sack. The rest of us kept them in our pockets. That's why marbles had such a unique smell. I know you may wonder who smelled marbles. Well, I did. If you carried around all those marbles in your pocket for a while, they would take on the smell of that pocket. Depending on what else you had in your pocket, the smell could be of apples or oranges or motor oil, or the good clean smell of dirt. The smell made them yours. Pokemon and Nintendo will never replace marbles. Sometime, somewhere, a shiny, colorful sphere will catch the eye of an imaginative child, yet again. Whatever happened to civility? It is with some sadness that I note the passing of what had come to be known as civility. I don't mean social graces like table manners and that sort of thing. Civility is the attitude itself. We North Carolinians have been known to be polite people. Growing up as I did in the small-town, rural South, there were certain things I was taught about how to deal with people. Most of the guidelines have some basis in the scriptures that we'd learned in Sunday school. I expect that's where my parents got their guidelines, and where their parents got theirs. And if it wasn't gospel when they got it, it became gospel by the time they told me about it. Of course, there's the Ten Commandments right off the bat. There are all your basic guidelines right there, handed down by God himself to Moses, who will forever look like Charlton Heston to me. After you get past some of the really strict thou shalt nots, like thou shalt not kill, it all boils down to treating everybody with the respect that you expect them to show you. That's where civility has gone out the back door. I always thought that if you met a funeral procession coming toward you on the highway, the respectful thing to do was to pull over to the side until it passed. That's a sign of respect for the family of the deceased. I don't see that much anymore. A Yankee friend of mine said that that was a Southern thing. I always thought that children should never talk back to their parents, particularly in public. I heard a lady in the grocery store the other day tell her adolescent son to push the shopping cart for her. With a bunch of folks standing within earshot, he told her the cart was too full for him to push. She'd have to push it herself. If I'd said something like that to my mother when I was that age, or any age, as soon as I could have picked myself up off the floor, my mama would have further publicly humiliated me right there in front of all those people by giving me a proper spanking. Despite growing up with some rough-and-tumble characters in the log woods and the sawmills, as well as listening to the raucous and sometimes extremely colorful language of men plowing mules, I rarely, if ever, heard a man use foul language in front of a lady. Now, not only do I hear men talking like that with ladies present, I often hear the ladies using the same language. There's a particular Southern phrase of instructions my mother would use when my sister and I would leave the house. After reminding us of the time we were to be home, she would always say, "Y'all be sweet now, you hear?" That phrase is the greatest instruction for civility ever uttered. It encompasses all the Ten Commandments, and probably every statute in every law book ever written. Given the fact that the Ten Commandments may not be posted in a public building anymore, I think it would be extremely meaningful to have that most civil approbation written over the door of every courthouse. To all those who enter here, y'all be sweet now, you hear? The Legacy of Mr. Sam. Let's just call him Mr. Sam. That wasn't his real name, but he'd be embarrassed if I let his real identity be known. You see, Mr. Sam was a modest man who never did like to draw attention to himself. He was also what folks called contentious. That means that his disposition ran from grumpy to ornery. He didn't have a whole lot to say to folks, and that just added to the opinion that most folks had of him as a grouchy old codger. Of course, Mr. Sam wasn't always old, and probably not always grumpy. He started out as a young man working on the railroad. He didn't work as a porter, either. He was a section hand, one of those fellows who went out every day and kept the tracks repaired. It was tough, demanding physical labor that didn't pay too well. He lived not far from Hallsboro, a bustling little sawmill town at the time. I only knew him after he had a family of 6 children, 3 boys and 3 girls, and a wife who worked as a domestic for the owner of the lumber company. He didn't own a car, nor even a mule and wagon. He and his family walked everywhere they had to go. Naturally, they didn't go very far, usually just to church on Sunday. More importantly, the children walked to school every day. He even built his house with the proximity of the school as a major consideration. School was very important to Mr. Sam. He knew that if his children were to better themselves and make a better place in the world for themselves than he had, they had to have a good education. I heard his children talking in my family's store about how their father made them study at night, and how he would sit right there with them until they had finished their studies. That was remarkable persistence on his part, since Mr. Sam never learned to read and write himself. I remember him coming by the store on his way home from work to buy some items. He'd be covered with the grit and grime of railroad work. I could tell he was tired from the strenuous labor, but he always stood straight, looked everyone in the eye, and was eager to be on his way. He seemed to have an important mission to accomplish. Mr. Sam's mission was to make sure his children made something of themselves. To the observer, it seemed like an impossible mission, given the circumstances. But to his eternal credit, he accomplished what he set out to do. All of his children not only graduated from high school, but also went on to college, and some of them got advanced degrees. They realized their father's dream. Mr. Sam earned all he could, saved as much as he could, and taught his children about honest work. He instilled in them the values they would need to become contributing members of society. Mr. Sam's achievement with his children is remarkable in itself, but there are some circumstances that make it even more so, given the attitude of so many today. You see, Mr. Sam was a black man in the 1950s. He never thought his children were less qualified to achieve success because of the color of their skin, and he didn't think anybody owed them anything they didn't earn. Mr. Sam left a proud legacy, not just in the achievements of his children, but also in the minds of all who knew him. He was a man who was not afraid to face challenges, a man who stood straight when others bent to adversity, and a man who never acknowledged anyone better than himself, nor asked any quarter in fighting for his goals. What may have seemed a grumpy disposition was really just a determined single-mindedness. High tea with barbecue and hush puppies. I've always respected and admired Southern ladies. There's something about women raised in the South that gives them a kind of gentility that puts everybody around them at ease. At the same time, there's a certain toughness about them that allows them to rise above whatever depressing circumstances might come their way. I knew a lady like that when I was growing up. My family owned a small oil distributing company from the 1950s until the late 80s. Back then, most of our business was providing fuel to tobacco farmers in the summer to fire their tobacco curers, and in the winter we provided kerosene or fuel oil for home heating. Miss Hazel was one of our winter customers. Miss Hazel was a real lady. She lived in a big two-story house that at one time had been a real showplace. It was kept up nicely, but it had deteriorated some since its heyday back in the 20s. The Great Depression had affected her family much like others around the country, and they had sought other ways to provide for themselves. Her husband had died right after World War II, and I never did figure out how Miss Hazel got her income. I know she was a substitute teacher sometimes, and she was very careful with her money. But even in her diminished financial situation, Miss Hazel never lost her sense of respectability, the dignity of her place in society, and that ability to make everyone she met feel as if they were the most important people in her life at that particular time. Each fall, Miss Hazel would call the oil plant and remind us that it was time for us to fill her oil tank. I was usually the one to make the delivery, and almost always there would be some small maintenance of her heating equipment involved. She had a very elegant dining room with a large fireplace at one end that had been covered with plywood with only a hole for the flue from a standing oil heater. On one delivery day, she wanted me to fit that flue into the wooden cover. I told her I'd have to put a flue collar on it to keep the metal from touching the wood. But this did not fit into Miss Hazel's aesthetic ideals. She had painted the wooden cover a dark blue, so now she instructed me to paint the flue and the cover dark blue, which I did. I filled the fuel tank, installed the flue and the collar, and painted them both a royal blue. That was not exactly the shade of blue Miss Hazel wanted to match the blue of the satin upholstery of the dining-room chairs, but I assured her that when the paint dried, it would match. She said, "Well, William, it is time for tea anyway, so why don't we have a bit of tea while we wait for the paint to dry?" I was standing there with oil and soot all over me, but I knew you never said no to Miss Hazel. So I washed up, and in just a few minutes she returned with a silver tray and two glasses of iced tea. "Now, William, I have some chocolate cookies or some of those little crackers if you'd like. But just between you and me, why don't we just have a bit of barbecue and hush puppies that I bought yesterday?" So we did. Miss Hazel and I sat there for quite a while, talking about my plans for college. We talked about Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman and Thoreau. Then we talked of the war, not World War II, but the War of Northern Aggression. She talked of her father, who had fought in that war, and when he came back after the war, and how he had built the farm back up. Then I will always remember what she said. "Then there were those other wars, but I don't remember them so much." When we had finished our barbecue and hush puppies, she noted that the stovepipe needed another coat of paint. I applied it, and she was satisfied. She moved from the old house some time ago, and it finally fell into ruin. Since then, I've had some great sweet tea, barbecue, and hush puppies, but it's never been quite the same. A Monument for Percy. All of us comprise a community. Some folks' contributions are more evident than others because they get more publicity, and there are others less known who make real contributions too. Percy was one of those folks. Percy lived in Brunswick County, right on the edge of the Green Swamp. He moved there back in the late 30s, before the war, as they say. I met him in 1970 when I worked for Regal Paper Corporation in the Woodlands Division. Percy lived in a community that was small in population, but covered a lot of territory. And, as is the nature of things, the number of inhabitants decreased as death wound its way through the trees and bogs, the snakes and alligators, and the occasional angry neighbor. In those early years, many of the men who worked in the swamps, some planting trees, some harvesting the trees, and some draining the swamps for better forestation, had no family with them. At times, the community was comprised of single individuals who lived alone and died alone. Percy was one of those solitary men, but he felt he was part of each man he met, and they were a part of him. So he took it upon himself to take care of those individuals when they died. When I met Percy, he was an old man. He had long ago retired from his job in the swamp and turned his full-time attention to taking care of a small burial plot not far from his house. It was a community cemetery, simply the final resting place for many of those men who had worked with Percy and had been a part of his life. Percy took me there one winter day and pointed out each plot marked with a single marker made of cypress, a long-lasting wood abundant in the nearby swamp. Some of those markers had deteriorated, and Percy had replaced them with another wooden marker. He couldn't afford a stone, but he thought the wood that had been such a part of all their working lives was appropriate to mark their resting place. He had carved the name and date of each man's death into the wood. He didn't know their birthdays. He kept the little plot cleared of weeds with a sling blade. He said the noise of lawnmowers didn't respect the dead, and he couldn't afford one anyway. I never returned to that tiny community or saw Percy again, and hadn't really thought about him until the other day when I saw a sign on the old Savings and Loan Building in Whiteville that said, "North Carolina Museum of Forestry." I think Percy would have been proud of such a venture, such a monument to the industry of which he had been a part. Percy knew a lot about monuments. love those Carolina girls. Throughout my life, I've had the good fortune of being associated with extraordinary women. Being born and reared in North Carolina gave me the unique opportunity to benefit from the tutelage of women who set a style that is both envied and emulated by other women around the world. I'm speaking, of course, of the Carolina girl. There are several distinctive classes of Carolina girls, all of them worthy of our admiration. The first one that comes to mind is the one we hear about in the beach music songs. She's always tan, and is almost always smiling and talking to people, some of whom she's just met, as if she'd known them all her life. This Carolina girl will lie on the beach in full makeup, including eyeshadow. Despite the heat, she'll never sweat, and her makeup will never run. As the night overtakes this Carolina girl, she can be found shagging to the music of the embers, then later sitting or standing barefoot on the dunes, or a pier, dressed in bright-colored sundress, her hair flowing in the ocean breeze, and the moonlight shining on her like a spotlight from heaven. Then there are the Southern Belles, the ones who go to the private schools and have their coming-out parties, maintaining a tradition as old as the families from which they come. In my youth, I met these young ladies at garden parties, chaperoned, as best they could, by their parents, as the enticing young ladies executed intricate plans to escape the restrictions of the chaperoning. Beneath the poised and polite exterior beat a heart determined to let the good times roll, with a certain amount of decorum, of course. Despite their best efforts to the contrary, these girls never forgot their mama's instructions. Always remember that you are a lady. Even as they flirted with us, they always made us country boys remember, too. There's another Carolina girl that often gets overlooked, the good old girl. She's the one we've known since we were little boys, the one who used to play baseball with us, go hunting with us, or go fishing off the pier at the beach. She never pretended to be anything she wasn't. She was often called a tomboy because she shunned the party dresses and the slumber parties, opting instead to go to the ball games with us. Then one day she grew up, and she was no longer one of the boys. She fell in love with one of those hunting buddies, and they got married after high school. She works in town as a secretary or as a waitress at one of the restaurants. She's got a good family, intends for her children to go to college, and makes sure they're in church every Sunday. She's the foundation of the small towns that cover this state. She's the one who makes sure there's food for the church dinners and goes to all the Little League baseball games. She's the Girl Scout leader, who helps out part-time at the school. And every once in a while, she'll go fishing on the pier at the beach. Think about the Carolina girls you know. I love them all. The Passing of Southern Gentlemen. There is a breed of man indigenous to the South, and that breed is fading away even as we speak. The Southern Gentleman. There are other species that seem to have overtaken this old breed, those that have a higher profile in the eyes of society. The subsequent diminution in recognition is contributing to the demise of the species. The good old boy, and even the redneck, are better known. They get more attention in the media. But I believe the Southern gentleman will endure. The characteristics that have stood him in good stead all these years are the characteristics that can survive. In fact, the true Southern gentleman seems to flourish in his semi-anonymity. Modesty is one of his most apparent characteristics. The Southern gentleman may be the last bastion of masculine gentility to be found anywhere. He abhors the boastful demeanor that so many see as an expression of the male's grasp of his role in society, a role perceived as being just slightly removed from Cro-Magnon man. He's as much at home driving a pickup truck as he is behind the wheel of a Cadillac. A Southern gentleman does not feel the need to make other people aware of his status in society. Instead, he chooses to let his daily interaction with his fellow man speak for him. He appreciates his neighbors for each individual's own attributes, regardless of his race or social background. There's much of the Renaissance man in the Southern gentleman. He has a broad interest in everything around him. He's appreciative and curious about the sciences and the nature of the world. He appreciates both the biological and the aesthetic intricacies that comprise the universe. In many cases, he is a son of the soil, a man tied to nature for his very existence. Subsequently, he is a religious man who has a strong faith in God and relies on that faith each time he plants a crop. He doesn't confine his athletic pursuits to the cumulative memory of sports statistics, but he appreciates the skill and effort that goes into achieving those statistics. He is aware of the need for the human body to reach and maintain a certain level of fitness, if only for the body to function at its maximal potential. A Southern gentleman appreciates the arts and is involved in some aspect of creativity that allows him to express the beauty of the language or languages we speak and the sights we see and the sounds we hear. Such an activity is not seen as unmasculine, but an expression of the God-given talents we all possess. A Southern gentleman has an appreciation for education that goes beyond his own personal achievements in that area. He's committed to education as a means of improving the individual and, in so doing, improving society. All of this belies the stereotype of the Southern gentleman as the master of the manor, content to sit on the veranda of his plantation house, sip bourbon, and talk about racehorses. Neither does he portray the scion of the New South, the man whose major role in life is the accumulation of wealth and power. He can be found most often in the small towns, where the quality of life is defined more by the Sunday morning church service than the maneuverings of the boardroom. These gentlemen are fading away. Each week I'm reminded of their passing as I attend more funerals of such men. I'm sorry to see them go. We will probably never see their like again, and we will all be the lesser for it. It will remain for those of us left behind, those of us born in a different time and in a different environment, to not merely revere the Southern gentleman as a memory of a bygone era, but to continue to honor his legacy by emulating him. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Triangle Yesteryear is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.
I think we can hear what I say. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina in the morning.